welcome to Throwing Mountains Weekly Strength. I'm your host, Chris Bollinger. For the next 15 minutes or so, we're going to draw strength from the Bible. I encourage you to make this a daily practice on your own. This is episode 1.12, God in the Day-to-Day, Temptation. The Bible passage for this episode is Hebrews 2, 14 to 18. This week I'll read from the New International Version, the NIV. Since the children have flesh and blood, he too shared in their humanity, so that by his death he might break the power of him who holds the power of death, that is, the devil, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. For surely it is not angels he helps, but Abraham's descendants. For this reason, he had to be made like them, fully human in every way, in order that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in service to God, and that he might make atonement for the sins of the people. Because he himself suffered when he was tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted. Last week, I discussed C.S. Lewis and how he struggled with his faith after the death of his beloved wife, Joy. Those struggles are reflected in Lewis's book entitled A Grief Observed. This week, I'm going to lean on Lewis again, this time with a much more popular book of his. It's a book in which temptation is the primary weapon of the main characters. It's the Screwtape Letters. In case you've never read it, let me give you a brief synopsis. As the title implies, the book is a series of letters, 31 in all, written by someone named Screwtape. Screwtape, it turns out, is not a person, but a devil or a demon. He's an experienced demon, and the letters are written to an inexperienced demon named Wormwood. In the letter, Screwtape advises Wormwood on how best to tempt a British man into sin and eventually into hell. In the Screwtape letters, Lewis essentially describes everything, including temptation, spiritual warfare, heaven and hell, God and Satan, from the point of view of the bad guys, demons. So, everything that is described as good is good for the minions of hell, so in actuality, it's bad or downright evil. Everything described as bad in the letters is, in reality, good. It's true, virtuous, beautiful, or good in some other way. The primary enemy in the book is not Satan, it's God. To give you a feel for this, let me read you a portion of one of the letters. Humans are amphibians, half spirit and half animal. The enemy's determination to produce such a revolting hybrid was one of the things that determined our father to withdraw his support from him. As spirits, they belong to the eternal world, but as animals, they inhabit time. This means that while their spirit can be directed to an eternal object, their bodies, passions, and imaginations are in continual change, for to be in time means to change. Their nearest approach to constancy, therefore, is undulation, the repeated return to a level from which they repeatedly fall back, a series of troughs and peaks. If you had watched your patient carefully, you would have seen this undulation in every department of his life. His interest in his work, his affection for his friends, his physical appetites, all go up and down. As long as he lives on earth, periods of emotional and bodily richness and liveliness will alternate with periods of numbness and poverty. The dryness and dullness through which your patient is now going are not, as you fondly suppose, your workmanship. They are merely a natural phenomenon which will do us no good unless you make a good use of it. To decide what the best use of it is, you must ask what use the enemy wants to make of it, and then do the opposite. Now, it may surprise you to learn that in his efforts to get permanent possession of a soul, he relies on the troughs even more than on the peaks. Some of his special favorites have gone through longer and deeper troughs than anyone else. The reason is this: to us, a human is primarily food. Our aim is the absorption of its will into ours, the increase of our own area of selfhood at its expense. But the obedience which the enemy demands of men is quite a different thing. One must face the fact that all the talk about his love for men and his service being perfect freedom is not, as one would gladly believe, mere propaganda, but an appalling truth. He really does want to fill the universe with a lot of loathsome little replicas of himself, creatures whose life, on its miniature scale, will be qualitatively like his own, not because he has absorbed them, but because their wills freely conform to his. The letters originally were published as weekly installments in a British gazette called The Guardian. Some gazette readers didn't understand that the letters were satirical. One man canceled his subscription with an angry letter, complaining that a lot of the advice given in these letters seemed not only erroneous, but positively diabolical. Which, well, was the point. Lewis wrote all the letters in about 6 months. He later commented on the project, "Though I had never written anything more easily, I never wrote with less enjoyment." Though it was easy to twist one's mind into the diabolical attitude, it was not fun, or not for long. The work into which I had to project myself when I spoke through Screwtape was all dust, grit, thirst, and itch. Every trace of beauty, freshness, and geniality had to be excluded. It almost smothered me before I was done. Clearly, viewing everything from the devil's point of view was very tiring for Lewis. Another thing that can be tiring is battling temptation. Our enemy knows this, and so the forces of evil tempt us relentlessly. And they get very good at knowing which types of temptations are most likely to lure us into sin, especially when we're tired of resisting. That's what makes the story of the temptation of Jesus so amazing. After he was baptized by John, Jesus went into the wilderness and fasted for 40 days. 40 days. He ate nothing for over a month. At the end, Matthew 4:2 tells us that Jesus was hungry. Do you think? I don't know how he functioned. When Jesus was at his weakest, Satan came calling. In reality, though, Satan had been there all along for the entire 40 days. The previous verse in Matthew tells us that Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. So how did Jesus resist temptation through a 40-day fast and at the end when he was at his absolute weakest point? He relied on God and the truth of God's word. Satan started by tempting Jesus to convert stones to food, which Jesus desperately needed. Jesus replied with Deuteronomy 8:3. So Satan tried to use scripture against Jesus. Taking Jesus to the top of the temple, Satan told Jesus to throw himself down because God would send angels to protect him, preventing him from striking his foot against a stone. That's from Psalm 91:11-12. Jesus replied with Deuteronomy 6:16. Satan's final temptation was to offer Jesus all the kingdoms of the world if he would worship Satan. Jesus sent the devil away by quoting Deuteronomy 6:13. Why did Jesus go through this ordeal? The answer is in the Hebrews passage that I read at the beginning of this episode. Because Jesus suffered when he was tempted, he is able to help us when we are tempted. Later in Hebrews, we are reminded that Jesus can sympathize with our weaknesses because he has been tempted as we are, yet was and is without sin. So when we're tempted, we need to rely on God. But we also can turn to something that Jesus didn't have when he was all alone in the wilderness: the support and help of a Christian brother. For an example of that, let's go to the Lord of the Rings trilogy. As you may recall, the hobbit Frodo is given the daunting task of destroying the Ring of Power, which has tempted men, hobbits, and all other humanoids in Middle-earth since it was forged thousands of years ago. To destroy the ring, Frodo must carry it from the peaceful Shire all the way to the heart of enemy territory, Mordor, and throw it into an active volcano called Mount Doom. In the first film, Frodo travels with the protection of the Fellowship of the Ring, which is composed of two men, Aragorn and Boromir, Gandalf the Wizard, the dwarf Gimli, the elf Legolas, Frodo, and three other hobbits, Merry, Pippin, and Samwise Gamgee, whom they call Sam. By the end of that film, Gandalf is gone, Boromir is dead, Merry and Pippin are captured, and Aragorn, Gimli, and Legolas are separated from Frodo and Sam. Rather than having a company of 8 to protect him, Frodo has only Sam for the rest of the dangerous journey to and into Mordor. As they continue this journey, the ring becomes a heavier and heavier burden for Frodo. Sam cannot carry the ring for his friend, but he remains beside Frodo every step of the way, doing whatever he can to help. At the end of the second film, The Two Towers, Frodo is ready to give up, but Sam says something that revives Frodo's spirits.
I can't do this, Sam. I know. It's all wrong. By rights, we shouldn't even be here. But we are. It's like in the great stories, Mr. Frodo. The ones that really mattered. Full of darkness and danger they were. And sometimes you didn't want to know the end. Because how could the end be happy? How could the world go back to the way it was when so much bad had happened? But in the end, it's only a passing thing. The shadow. Even darkness must pass. A new day will come. And when the sun shines, it'll shine out the clearer. Those were the stories that stayed with you, that meant something, even if you were too small to understand why. But I think, Mr. Frodo, I do understand. I know now. Folk in those stories had lots of chances of turning back, only they didn't. They kept going because they were holding on to something. What are we holding on to, Sam? But there's some good in this world, Mr. Frodo. And it's worth fighting for.
A little later, Frodo and Sam continue the conversation.
I wonder if we'll ever be put into songs or tales.
What?
I wonder if people will ever say, let's hear about Frodo and the ring. And they'll say, yes, it's one of my favorite stories.
Frodo was really courageous, wasn't he, Dad?
Yes, my boy. The most famousest of hobbits. And that's saying a lot.
You've left out one of the chief characters.
Samwise the Brave.
I want to hear more about Sam.
Mr. Frodo, you shouldn't make fun. I was being serious. So was I.
Samwise the Brave.
Men, each of us needs a Samwise the Brave, a godly friend who will encourage us and hold us accountable as we strive to battle our temptations. And each of us needs to be a Samwise the Brave to another man. Next week, I'll talk about work. I hope you'll join me for that. Please pick up a copy of 52 Weeks of Strength for Men. You'll find it to be a good resource on this journey. Have a good week, men.